Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Eve, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm certainly extremely happy to be here. I know Betty L. very well back in New York, and I'm deeply touched that she would recommend that I come out here. I remember from the days that I was there, we weren't supposed to make recommendations. You know, you always equivocate things when you're working out of general service. Any of you who've had the experience writing letters will find that you never get a directive. Somebody will say, well, our experience has been that perhaps if you tried to do what another group in another area did, you might be able to solve the problem. And so we would never give the name of a speaker. Particularly, we'd say, well, we understand that so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so have been fairly well received in various areas, but never specifically. So I'm very grateful to Betty for suggesting that I come here, although I'm afraid that she has given him a few false ideas. However, it's wonderful to be here, and I thank the committee and all of them for having me here, because what a beautiful place. What a beautiful place for an AA conference. I've never been to Yosemite, so I was thrilled with the opportunity of being able to be here and to see it. And I spent the afternoon traveling around and was so fortunate I had an open-air tram, damn near froze to death, but it was open. You know, I could see everything, whereas in a bus I wouldn't have been able to. And I thought to myself, who couldn't have a sense of spirit and a sense of this tremendous creative force in our world? If you're here and you see this tremendous valley and these tremendous cliffs all around it and the way nature works, and here we are, right here in the hand, you might say, of a spiritual experience with this creative force behind us. And so I'm very grateful to be here. And I must confess, I remind myself a little bit of that old saw about Christopher Columbus, because I did get here from Fort Lauderdale by way of Los Angeles, Tokyo, Shanghai, Suzhou, Hangzhou, Beijing, Xi'an, Chongqing, Dazhou, Wuhan, Guilin, Guangzhou, Hong Kong, Burbank, and Walnut Creek. You know the old story about Christopher Columbus, of course. It's pretty certain that he must be an alcoholic, because he didn't know where he was going when he started. He didn't know where he'd been when he got back, and a Dane financed the whole thing. And your committee has very kindly been generously financing my travel expenses out here, and I am truly grateful. I'm one of those people who thinks AA is absolutely fantastic. I don't suppose there's anybody in this room that doesn't. Of course, Vince may not have liked it so much at the beginning, but all of us have had those times when we first got sober, I think, when we've had questions in our minds. Sometimes not questions about our alcoholism. I never had any question about that. But I had terribly deep questions about my ability to be able to make this program work. Because I was one of those people who had such a terrible sense of lack and such a terrible sense of low self-esteem and such a terrible sense of unworthiness that by the time I got to A, there wasn't much left of me, and I really and truly was fearful that I would not have the opportunity to find here what all of you were so obviously showing, the joy and the happiness that one finds in AA. And I'm always thrilled by that sentence in the big book in the family afterwards chapter, in which it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I think that's the key. You know, if we didn't enjoy life, we wouldn't stay sober. And that's the wonderful part about it. We don't believe, I think, when we first get sober, that there's any possible way we can enjoy life without a drink. You know, it just seemed impossible. And yet here we are. Right now, I think we're enjoying life to the absolute fullest. We know where we've been. We know where we want to go. We have learned so much about ourselves. We've learned how to love and how to appreciate other people, so that we really and truly have a handle on living that we've never had before. And I've often said that I'm very grateful I'm an alcoholic. And I remember when I first got sober and I heard people say that, I thought they were nuts. Because how could you be grateful for the destruction you'd wreaked in your life? How could you be grateful for the feelings of degradation, remorse, guilt, fear, loneliness, all those things that we experience? But I'm grateful because I know, as a result of my alcoholism, I was able to find AA. And where else do people have a program? Where else do people have guidelines to live that we find in AA? And of course, we don't realize that when we first get sober. You know, I had no idea what sobriety was all about when I first got sober. I just thought it meant not drinking. And it's a good thing sometimes they don't tell us it's kind of tough. You know, just come around, just stick around, you'll get it, you know, just keep on coming, you know, and so on. And they don't tell us about the pain. It's just as well they don't. We might leave. Because it is work. We do have to work. And every now and then you hear somebody say the program didn't work for me or didn't work for him, didn't work for Vince. But he found out why. Because it isn't that the program just works. We have to work it. And that's the important thing. And that's the excitement, isn't it? Because there's always change. There's always challenge. Who knows what tomorrow is going to bring? We never know what's going to be asked of us. And yet we know that tomorrow will be different from today. It will be asked to do something else, and we're going to be able to meet that challenge. And that, to me, is the excitement of the thing. I love the fact that we don't claim spiritual perfection. Can you imagine how God-awful it would be if we were all perfect? Life would be bloody dull. You know, if there was no challenge in living, if everything was beautiful all the time, how would you know when you were happy if you never were unhappy? You wouldn't. So I think it's wonderful that we have the challenges and we grow with those. What's the old saw? You know, no pain, no gain. And unfortunately, it seems to be true that we don't really and truly learn except from our own experience. How many of us have been told over the years, you know, you're drinking too much or you have a problem? Oh, I can handle it. I can stop any time I want to. I just don't want to. You know, that one. And so we have to learn from our own experience. And it's this experience that we try and share, that experience, strength and hope, which is the keynote of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because other people have said, if you do this, and you do this, and you do this, and so forth. But it's when a member of AA says, I did this too. When a member of AA says, I felt like that. And you see, I think that's terribly important. I felt like that. Because to me, this is a feelings illness, and it's a feelings recovery program. It's not up here. It's in here. And how many times have we seen people come in and analyze? And analyze, and analyze, and not be able to get it because they can't get it in their heart. You know, we used to say, listen, with an open, what did we used to say? They couldn't have said, listen with an open head. That doesn't make sense. Mind. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, and now I'm okay. Thanks a lot. Listen with an open mind, and I always figure that they would go in one ear and out the other, so I like to say, listen with an open heart. You'll have to forgive me. I don't know whether it's senility or whether it's Alzheimer's or what, but I do seem to be failing in my memory sometimes, and words suddenly will leave me. I mean, after all, I am 77 years old, so I figure maybe I have an opportunity here. One day at a time. And no matter what happens, it's better than the alternative. And so every now and then I lose my train of thought or I lose my words. But listen with an open mind. No, listen with an open heart. And I'm glad I heard that when I first came around because it was terribly important for me. I'm one of those people who believes I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. Now, when I used to say that 20 years ago, you know, people were kind of startled. But thank goodness today we are beginning to recognize the fact that alcoholism can strike us at any age. And that probably our alcoholism starts very early on. If we're alcoholics, it's there, it's in us. You know the old saying, alcoholism is a little bit like pregnancy. There's no such thing as being a little bit. You either is or you isn't. And it's a matter of degree. And the more it shows, the more it grows, the more it shows. And I think that We used to wait till the ninth month, you know what I mean, before we were finally willing to give up and surrender and relinquish those controls that we were trying to hang on to so hard. And I think today we see more and more young people coming into the program, perhaps coming in the third or fourth month if we can follow on with my simile. And I think that's a wonderful thing, so that we know that young people can be alcoholic. But back in my day, back in the 19th century, people didn't talk about things like that or know about things like that. And so nobody questioned whether or not I was an alcoholic. And people are always willing to make excuses for you. And we hang on to those. Those are wonderful when people give us reasons for why we drink. Legitimate reasons, you know. But I was one of those people who from the very start had those feelings of inadequacy, of loneliness, of not belonging, of always feeling apart from instead of a part of. All of those feelings of isolation, inability to communicate, lack. And it is a terrible feeling that I was never going to amount to anything, that I wasn't worth much anyway. And during my growing up years, those feelings lingered. I had difficulty making friends. My mother died when I was 12, and I had two younger sisters. And you know, sometimes we get ideas about ourselves from what other people say. And of course, back in those days, I was very tall. I'm 5'8 and a half, or at least I was in my younger years. I guess at 77, I may have shrunk a little. But I felt enormous. They didn't grow Brooke Shields back in those days. And if I ever had a date, which was very unusual, I might add, generally the guy's head was on my chest, you know. And it got to be a very uncomfortable period growing up. But when I was 12 and my mother died, my father tried very hard to take good care of his children. He was a wonderful man, loving, kind, caring. But he didn't know much about girls. But anyhow, he'd take us over to see friends on a Sunday, and I can hear him to this day introducing us, his little brood. And he would point to my younger sister, who was then about 6, and he'd say, this is Daddy's peach and cream. Peach, we call her Peach, because her skin is like a peach. She was very sweet. And you'd hear people all around the room saying, oh, poor little thing, you know, her mother just died, and they'd ooh and ah over her. And then he'd get to my next sister, and he'd say, and this is the beauty of the family. And everybody'd say, isn't she lovely? She was. She went on to make Daisy Chain at Vassar. She was very beautiful. Then there'd be a long pause. And he would say, and this is Daddy's big girl. And I used to wish the whole floor would open up and swallow me, because I knew I was big. You know, I was all arms and knees and nose. You know, I had this enormous nose. They used to say, you have a Roman nose. It's Roman all over your face. And of course, that didn't make me feel any better. And so I was miserable and uncomfortable with myself. I never felt any confidence in me. And I finally went off to college. And I went young. I went at 16. You know, we're bright. Not necessarily intelligent. There is a difference. But I was smart, you know, bright, and I got into college at 16. But I was about as ready for college as nothing. I knew nothing about getting along with people. I knew nothing about communicating. I'd passed my grades, but I was socially totally inept and unable to get along with other people. And when we got up there, my father had brought me up, and they had chapel. I went up to my room, and I found that I had been assigned a roommate. And I tell this story quite often because to me it kind of exemplifies the way in which I felt, and I think very often the way we're apt to feel. Anyhow, I took one look at her and my heart went down in my boots. I was terrified. She was also from Greenwich, Connecticut. I don't know what you'd have out here to compare with Greenwich, Connecticut. Marin County, maybe? I don't know. But in any event, you know, very tweety, horsey, very social set. And here I am, a poor little waif from Brooklyn, New York. And I with none of the graces, social or otherwise, just the disgrace later. But anyway, I went down to the chapel to meet my father, and I said, Daddy, please take me home. I can't stand here. Take me home. Take me home. And he said, come on now. You're Daddy's big girl. You can handle it. And he left, and so I went back upstairs to my room, only to discover that that roommate had requested a transfer. I had total and immediate rejection. I was sick at heart, and I felt absolutely terrible. I felt worthless, useless, nobody can get along with me, even a new roommate is asked to move, and I was in despair, and felt those awful feelings of inferiority. At which point, my new roommate walked in. She had long, greasy hair, stack of books, eyeglasses, which I didn't wear then. And I took one look at her and I thought, my God, you know, here I have been absolutely at the depths of despair and feelings of inferiority, and this new girl walks in, and I draw myself up inside and say, but I deserve better than this. Always those feelings on the one hand of inferiority and unworthiness, and the next minute of superiority and arrogance. And I had those ambivalent feelings for many, many years, and never could quite understand them until I finally got into the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think is a wonderful step as we begin to learn to know who we are. Because I don't believe I ever knew who I was until I got to AA. And I think many of us do not know really and truly who we are, what we're capable of, and what our motivation is. And we learn all that through the program. So there I was, happily at college, only I wasn't very happy. I didn't fit in very well. And, of course, this is back in Prohibition. This is back in 1924, 25. But I knew I was going to go to Europe at the end of my sophomore year, because back in those days, any father who was worth his salt would beg, borrow, or steal enough money to get his child to go to Europe with about 15 chaperones. God, times have changed. And anyhow, so I was going to go to Europe at the end of my sophomore year. And so I thought to myself, I won't drink until I get to Europe. Because when I get to Europe, I'll drink as Europeans do. You know, a little gracious wine with my meals. I won't drink the way these Prohibition babies are, out of the hip flask. You're all too young to remember Prohibition. Great experiment. A great and wonderful experiment. It created alcoholism, I do believe, because it made drunkenness socially acceptable for the first time in our culture. In any event, I decided that when I got to Europe, I would drink graciously a little wine with my meals. And so we got on board the ship, and 12 miles out, they began to serve. And I didn't know what to order, and the person next to me ordered an orange blossom, so I thought, well, I'll order an orange blossom, and I ordered it. Never was one of my favorite drinks thereafter, but that's all right. But that, at that point, it was terrific. Because, you know, I drank that orange blossom, and you know what happened? You do. I shrank. I got to be 5'2", eyes of blue, and adorable. And so I knew that I had found the elixir. I had found the coping medicine. I had found the way in which I could live. And that's why I know I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. Because, you see, I believe it's so terribly important that we understand that the clue is not what does alcohol do to you, but it's what alcohol does for you. And it's when alcohol is that magic. It's when alcohol provides you with a modus operandi, when alcohol is your coping medicine, when alcohol lets you live and you can't live otherwise. You're an alcoholic, and I don't care if you're 17 years old as I was at that time, or some of these kids we see today at 11, 12, 13, and 14 sticking their toes in AA in various places. There's no reason why you can't recover from alcoholism at a very young age. And I'm so grateful today to see so many young people coming into our program, coming into treatment facilities. Excuse me, Vince. Some of them do help, you know. Okay. To see young people able to begin this journey of recovery at an age when they have a whole life ahead of them, instead of, as so many of us, had to wait a little longer and go through some of the pain. Anyhow, I got back to college, and of course, by that time, now I'm with it, kid. Boy, of course, we didn't do that then. We Charlestoned. But anyway, whatever it was we did, I did it. And I did it just so well that I got kicked out at the end of my junior year. And I remember when my father came up to get me, and I felt perfectly terrible. I felt so awful. I felt so ashamed. I felt so remorseful. And yet, you know, I couldn't talk about it. You know, we don't talk about those things that are close to us. And I felt badly because my mother had been to Vassar, my sister was coming the following year, and here I'd loused up. And but I wanted to throw myself in my father's arms and tell him how sorry I was. But, you know, we don't do things that way. It's so hard for us, at least it was for me. And, of course, what I did was to say, you know, Dad, this place is terrible. If they hadn't kicked me out, I'd have left anyway, because it's an impossible situation. I put the big bluff on, you know. I couldn't let him know how badly I felt and how hurt I was at myself and how despairing I was. And then I went on and I said, but of course, you know, I know what I want to do with my life. You've known that for many years. He said, yes, I know you think you want to go on the stage. And I said, of course I want to go on the stage. I want to be in the theater. And so he made a few phone calls and got me a job. My father was a playwright, and I had an uncle who was a rather famous actor. And the result was I didn't really have to work for any of it. And so I went ahead and I was on the stage. I was in the theater. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. But, you know, it's a funny thing. The theater and booze are not good companions. And I was already an alcoholic. And so I got into trouble during my 9 or 10 years that I fooled around with the theater. And I didn't get very far. But it wasn't until I got to AA and I began to look at that whole experience that I began to recognize what it was. You know, I had thought I wanted to be an actress. You know, that wasn't it. Not really. I didn't really want to go through all the hard work of learning how to walk gracefully, but books on my head, learning how to dance so I could be graceful, learning how to project my voice to the last row in the balcony. We didn't have these things then. You know, I didn't really want all that. You know what I wanted. I wanted instant recognition. I wanted to be a star. I wanted my name in lights. I wanted people to rush up to me and say, oh, you were so wonderful. You know, I think it's because I felt that, and this, of course, is after AA. Incidentally, everything I say is really is hindsight. You know, when you come right down to it, if I knew all the things then about me that I learned in AA, perhaps I could have stopped my alcoholism at an earlier age, but I didn't. But I've learned the things that I talk about. I've learned these things through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the program, through the 12 steps, and from you. And so I began to look at that, and I recognized that this terrible need for approval, this terrible need for people to praise me, this terrible need for other people to say I was okay, was the way in which I thought maybe I could think I was okay. And I think there are many of us like this. We're such perfectionists. Have you ever 12-stepped anybody and had them say, well, I wanted to be the second best professor at UCLA, or I wanted to be the second best stenographer in our office? No. We always want to excel. We're always trying to prove something. And I think part of it is this terrible need we have to prove it to ourselves, because we have these feelings that we're not okay. And that's what we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we're not only okay, we're terrific. And I think each one of us has to begin to come to have an understanding of that inner core of self that each one of us has. We're each born with. We lose our way. We stray. We don't live up to our potentials. But we have the opportunity here to begin to be the kind of person we always wanted to be. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I don't ever remember hearing anybody say, at 17, I went home to my father and I said, Daddy, I want to be an alcoholic. I just don't think we thought that way. We're alcoholic because we have a disease, because we have an illness. And now we have an opportunity to again look at ourselves and become the kind of people we always wanted to be. And so eventually, of course, I didn't go on working in the theater. I forgot to add, as an afterthought, I started doing something else we do. I started getting married. I got married to a darling young actor, and we used to, you know, dream about the future and how we were going to have our own company and be stars and all the rest of it. And we never, of course, did anything about today. So that future never happened. We never lived in the now. We were always either living in the past or in the future. In any event, I had a beautiful little boy as a result of that marriage. Pretty soon we were divorced. And so then I was out on my own. I wasn't on the stage anymore, and I had to earn a living to support my baby and my child. And so I began doing other kinds of things. And at one point, I finally met a man who I thought was absolutely marvelous. He drank the same way I did. And I thought, this is perfect. What's more, at that time, I was what you might call an art snob. If you weren't in the arts, thank you, I didn't want anything to do with you. You know, if I said, what do you do? And you said, I'm the president of General Motors, I would have said, oh, really? you know. But if you said you were a half-assed actor, pardon my English, I would have thought you were terrific. Or if you were writing, never sold anything, but you were writing, I thought it was wonderful. Well, this guy who drank the way I did had been one of the earliest radio announcers in the old days of the blue and red networks. And the result was that he was acceptable to me. The fact that he was unemployable by radio didn't interest me, but he was acceptable. Anyhow, we drank the same way, and I thought he was terrific. And, of course, we got married. I thought it was going to be absolutely wonderful, because we did love each other. We really did, and he was a beautiful human being. So many alcoholics are so beautiful inside, but they're all buried beneath all this crap. You should be grateful I said it that way. We're both alcoholics, and neither one of us knew it. We really didn't know what it was all about, and things began to happen. My son came to live with us. We had two beautiful daughters of our own, and the drinking continued. And people would come up to me and say, Evie, you know, you're drinking an awful lot. And I'd say, I know it. It's that son of a bitch, Roger. I have to drink to stand living with him, you know. I had my built-in excuse. He was my reason. I had drawn down that curtain of memory that we all managed to do so easily and had tucked away way back in the nether regions of my brain where it wouldn't come up and hit me, that I'd been kicked out of college for drinking on the campus, that I'd been thrown off of a train in Providence, Rhode Island for drunken disorderly conduct and landed in a jail. I was in a blackout, and I want to tell you, I'm very grateful for blackouts. I do not care to know what I did that night. And so I was forgetting these things, and I would use Roger as the excuse for why I was drinking so much. But meanwhile, those terrible feelings of guilt and remorse and degradation were beginning to come more and more into my heart, because I adored my children. I really and truly, I think I probably loved them more than I loved my husband. We used to fight a lot. It's hard, two alcoholics married together. You know, I used to get terrible black eyes, sometimes two at a time, you know. And I can remember, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd know, you know. And so I would give him a loving little tap in the bed next to me. Ah, look what you did to me last night, you know. And his stock answer was, what did you do to deserve it? And I would say to myself, me? Deserve it? This saint-like person that you're married to, that you abuse, you know. Well, I'm going to have to tell you a little something here. I eventually got sober, of course. I lived with Roger 6 years that I was in AA and sober, and he got drunk every night of the week. And during those 6 years, I never had a black eye. One of the little lessons in learning to be responsible for your own actions. It took me a little time to get on to that one. In any event, things progressed. We used to have terrible fights and all the terribly sordid things that go on when you've got two alcoholics living together in a home. And I hated myself. And I used to have god-awful hangovers because I used to keep trying to stop. He never had a hangover because he'd have a drink and go to work, and then he'd drink all day and he'd come home and it was the same old pattern. But I was always trying to stop, and the result was that I was always in terrible shape. And I remember one morning taking my older daughter was 3, and I'd put her in a nursery school. I thought if I've only got the baby at home, maybe things won't be so difficult. My son, of course, was 13 or so, and he was going to a school downtown. And this one morning, I felt so sick, and I said to my little Ruthie, I said, Ruthie, honey, do you mind? We lived in New York City and had to take an elevator down to the lobby, and the school bus came and picked her up. And I said to her, this 3-year-old, I said, darling, would you mind going down to the lobby and waiting for the school bus by yourself? And she looked at me with these great yellow eyes that she has. And she said, oh, Mommy. So I thought, well, I'll go. So I had a quick slug, you know. And I had a blue seersucker house coat, I guess you'd call it, with big red flowers over it. It practically held itself up. It didn't get into the laundry very often because I used to sweat in it. Do you remember? So I went down to the lobby with dark glasses on. One always wears dark glasses in the lobby of a New York apartment at 8 o'clock in the morning. And people would greet me, looking at me strangely, and I would say, good morning, hoping they wouldn't catch the breath. And I'd stand out there waiting for that school bus, and I would wonder what in hell had happened to me. Where was the girl who'd been so full of ideals, and so full of hope, and so full of a real ambition, and so full of real wanting to care about people and about things? What had happened? What had happened? Where was I? And of course, I didn't realize that I was sick. But I suddenly had that recognition of the fact that alcohol had taken over my life. And I felt so degraded. And she'd go off to school, and I'd go upstairs. And of course, I felt so degraded, I had to have another drink. And the process would go on over and over again. My son, by this time, is spending a lot of time outside of the home. And I remember to him, I spoke to him one day, and I said, darling, why do you go out every evening? Why do you go up to the roof to watch the ships? We lived on Hudson River on Riverside Drive, and it was during the war years, and great convoys of our ships, merchant marine ships that were going to take things to the Allies, would convene there in the Hudson River right outside our windows, and you'd get up on the early morning and they'd all be gone. They would drift out to sea at night, camouflaged and so forth, and he'd go up to the roof to watch them. And I said, darling, why don't you stay home? And he looked at me and he said, Mother, I can't stand to stay at home and watch you get drunk. Well, that hit me. That hit me hard. About that time, my mother-in-law came to visit us. Her visit was planned. She was an elderly lady, and so she came to see us. And that morning, she arrived on schedule, but we were both of us in bed with such hangovers that we hadn't been able to get up. And I realized how out of control my life was, because up until then, I was sure that I would have greeted her properly. And so she came in, and somehow I managed to pull myself together. Roger, of course, had a drink, went to work. And I managed to get meals and try and be the nice daughter-in-law and so on, shaking, falling apart. And she left the next day. She didn't stay for the visit. But she left a little note on the refrigerator, and I have never forgotten it. She said, my dear children, the world frowns upon inebriates. 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 Those of you who don't like the word alcoholic, try inebriate on it. We could start a whole new fellowship, Inebriates Illuminated or something. In any event, she said, I have written to the Alcoholic Foundation, which was the forerunner of the General Service Office. The old name for what is now the General Service Office. She said, I've written to the Alcoholic Foundation and asked them to send you some literature. Well, about 2 days later, the literature arrived. They were faster then than they are now. But that pamphlet was wonderful. It was one pamphlet that had a story of a woman in it. And I read that, and I thought, my God, I am not the only person who does degrading, terrible, despicable, dirty, rotten, selfish, unbelievable things that I do. And I had immediately that feeling of, I'm not alone. And so I asked Roger if he wouldn't go to AA with me. He said, I told you that before. You see, I had read the Jack Alexander piece in 1941, and I had thought if he would go to AA, then I would be all right, because the only reason I drank is because of him, you know. I hadn't come to grips with the fact that my alcoholism was my problem. And so he gave me the same answer, no, he wasn't interested. And I was so sick at that time that there was no way I could do anything alone. I was afraid to go out, I was afraid to stay in. If I was in the house, the walls would close in on me. If I went out, I'd think I was going to pass out, fall down, my palms would be all sweaty. And I had two darling little girls at home. And I also had a neighbor little girl who lived in the same building, who was my daughter's best friend, and one of my many, many children that I have kind of floating around the world. And incidentally, Jenny is right here, and I just visited her in Walnut Creek. I hadn't seen her in 30 years, 25 years, and we got together just a very short while ago. And she's got a year of sobriety. And I... And so I had these children to look after and take care of, and I just felt absolutely hopeless about myself and my own situation, and he wouldn't go. And so I thought that I had to go by myself somehow manage my life. And so I told my son at that point that I knew I was an alcoholic. I said, honey, I know I'm an alcoholic. I finally come to recognize that. And I said, I promise you, I will never take another drink. This was in March of 1944. And of course, I couldn't live up to that. But I didn't realize it. And I really meant what I said, but I seemed to want to back it up because I remember saying to him, I promise you that if I can't do it on my own, I will go to AA. And I meant that promise with all my heart because I had broken every promise I'd ever made to him. And so I went away for the summer with the children, and of course I did not stay sober. And when I came back to New York in October, finally, after spending months up there in the country, with the kids. You never kept your children in New York. You could help it during the summer months. And when I got back, I could not get off the sauce. I could not stop, and I kept trying. And finally, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called them at night. I was drunk. I told them I had a problem. I told them my husband had a problem. I thought our Newfoundland dog had a problem. And they recognized the fact that I was in no shape to talk, so they said, well, why don't we talk to you tomorrow? So they began calling me early in the morning, and they called all day, and they kept saying, when are you coming down? And I said, well, I have read that you send people to my home. And they said, well, we're very sorry, but there isn't anybody here right now, but come on down, we'd like to see you. Well, eventually, after several drinks, I got up enough courage, and I went down to the place where AA was in existence at that time in New York City, at the old 24th Street Clubhouse. It was at 324 and a half West 24th Street. And I remember none of us ever knew where the little half was, but that was where the house clubhouse was. And I went down there. I had to take three buses. I was in fear and trembling, and I got down to the clubhouse, and I stood outside that door, and I looked in, and there was a kind of a long hallway, and we used to call it the last mile. But if you stood out in the street and you looked in, you could see this hallway. But at the end of the hallway, you could see light. And there was a big living room that went across there. And I saw the light at the end of the hall, and I heard laughter. And I went in. And, of course, I not only found light and laughter, I found life and love in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, when I got there, I didn't know what I was going to find. As I said before, I thought that sobriety just meant not drinking. I didn't realize that I had to work. I didn't realize that I had to affect changes in me. I didn't realize that I had to change myself. You see, I heard that serenity prayer, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And I thought, well, that means I have to stay the way I am. That means I have to accept myself as being worthless and not able to communicate and homely. Oh, my God, I thought I was homely. And I'm never going to amount to anything. I have to accept myself. Courage to change the things I can. I'm going to change Roger. And it took me a little time in the program before I found out that the only person that I could change is myself. And oh, how hard that is sometimes for us to accept. You know, I think if we could all accept that one premise, you know, people don't behave. If we could accept that, life would be so much easier. But my God, they don't behave. You get things all planned for people, and they don't behave. And I had to let go of Roger. I had to let go of trying to take his inventory, and I had to begin to work on mine. And I remember how hard it was for me to receive what you were giving me, because I was so locked up. I had such a world around me. I really and truly was terrified of people, so I thought. And it wasn't until I got into the fourth step that I was able to look at that and wonder, what am I afraid? What am I afraid of? I'm not afraid that you're going to hit me or hurt me. What am I afraid of? And of course, you know, I was afraid you weren't going to like me. I was afraid you wouldn't approve of me. I was afraid that I wouldn't measure up. Oh, those terrible neurotic intangible fears. And don't tell me that a neurotic fear isn't just as real as any legitimate fear. And I'm not so sure that a neurotic fear isn't a legitimate fear. Because God knows it can have you in its grip and hold you there. And that's the thing I had to learn to get rid of, was fear. I'd lived with fear all my life. And I found the answers in the AA program. But it took me a long time because I had such a wall. I wouldn't receive what you were trying to give me. I was so fearful of rejection. You know, I knew how hopeless I was. I knew what a mess I was. It hadn't been very long before that my husband, sitting across the room from me, looking at me one day, said, "You know, you're the homeliest goddamn woman I ever knew." I believed it. I believed it. And I went into AA with that feeling of lack of self-worth, that I wasn't any. And I remember that first day I talked with Dan, who ended up by being my sponsor, when I went into that club room and I talked to him a little bit, and he told me all about himself, of course. And I was glad he did, because I could see that he was a kindred soul. But when we got all through, I finally thought, well, he's being so good, I must say one more thing. And so I turned to him and I said, "Dan, I really have to come clean." He said, "What is it?" I know he thought I was going to tell him I'd murdered my mother or something. I said, "There's one more thing I have to tell you." And he said, "What's that?" I said, "I have an inferiority complex." Well, he did just what you did. He laughed, you know, and I started to shrivel again, you know, inside. And then he called over to some people at the next table, at a table on the other side of the room, all drinking coffee. And he said, "This babe says she's got an inferiority complex." And they laughed. And, you know, for a minute or two, it was touch and go. But fortunately, I recognized the fact that you were laughing with me, not at me. And that's the key, because we care about each other. But I found it very hard to get up and say, "Hi, my name is Eve, and I'm new." I was terrified of rejection. And so I couldn't do that. There was one girl that came in about the same time I did, down there at 24th Street. And I used to kind of go in with her, because we kind of sort of knew each other because we'd gone in together kind of thing. And then she got a boyfriend. She had some guy who was staying sober, and they hooked up together, and I didn't see her anymore. And then they both got drunk. So I figured, well, that isn't the way to do it. And so I went on my way, and I finally began to be able to talk to other women, and I finally began to make a little bit of progress. And eventually, I was able to go to work at the New York Intergroup office as a volunteer. And this was wonderful for me, because I was sitting behind a desk, which made me feel that I was legitimate. I could never take a 12-step call in those days and go into some person's home, stranger, and present myself and say, "I understand you're interested in the fellowship of alcohol." I mean, I couldn't do this. I was so terrified. But put me behind a desk with a telephone, you know, you're giving me some legitimacy. Now, I have a right to tell you something about Alcoholics Anonymous. You come to me, and I'll be happy to tell. I mean, I was such a mess, you know. It's a miracle that I stayed sober. But I found it wonderful there because I began to get to know other people, and I began to see how other people changed. And that's a wonderful thing when you begin to watch people come in, and then they come in the next week, and they thank you. And they say, "What you said last week was so helpful to me." And, oh, you begin to feel, well, I'm not so bad. Maybe, you know, maybe there's hope for me. You begin to make a little progress. And then you get worried about whether you're making progress or not. And you speak to somebody about it. And they say, "You're making progress." And I say, "How do you know?" They say, "Well, you're sober. And in this program, you either go backwards when you get drunk, or you go forwards when you stay sober. There's no standing still. And you're sober, so you're making progress." Oh, that helped a lot. That helped a lot. And so I began to slowly begin to try and work the AA program. I had no difficulty whatsoever with the first step. I knew damn well I was an alcoholic. And I never had any feeling of shame or a stigma about being an alcoholic. I loved knowing I was an alcoholic. It was so infinitely better than everything I thought I was. I was proud to be an alcoholic. My God. You know, the old big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in those days had a cover on it which was bright red and yellow with big red and yellow letters on it. And, you know, you could see it 15 miles away. And they had a reversible cover so that if you wanted to read the book in public, you could turn the cover around and nobody would know what you were reading. Not me. I'd get on the bus going home from meetings with my Alcoholics Anonymous book, red, yellow cover, blatant, you know. Thinking, God, I hope everybody sees that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Boy, oh boy, I'm carrying the message this way, you know. I had such mistaken ideas about things, really and truly. I don't know how I ever grew at all, but I did make some progress. I did grow, and as I said before, the fourth step, of course, the second step, I recognized that this program had a power. I recognized that there was something in these rooms that I couldn't define, which today I call spirit or God, and I recognized then that this was something, and so I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The third step, I couldn't make the decision because I didn't think I knew who God was. And I beg of you, if you're at that point in your sobriety where you're beginning to make your search about spiritual matters, and I'm not talking about religion. There is no religion in Alcoholics Anonymous, and pray God, there is never any religion in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, at the General Service Office, we've turned down about six offers of a concordance to the big book. God, no! Let's each one of us interpret this program in the way that's going to help us the most. Let's not have a rigidity and not be flexible. We've got to grow. We've got to be flexible. And so a concordance is like, you should do it this way here, and on page 47 you will do this and that, and so on. So we don't do that. We do it our own way. And I couldn't do that third step. I had to begin to find out. Was that me? I had to begin to find out what I thought my higher power was, what I thought was spiritual, what I thought was the spirit that I wanted to have my confidence and faith in. The result was I didn't make the decision. And the third step says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. And so it was a little while before I got to that. And I know that many people advocate taking the steps in order, but I feel it's important that we take them when we're ready for them. Take them when we're not ready for them sometimes, too. But what I mean to say is don't, if you're stymied on a step, I think it's important to begin to explore the other steps. At least that worked for me. And that's how I got into the fourth step. And to me, the fourth step was incredible. Because I discovered I had such misconceptions about me. I didn't really know who I was. I had believed a lot of things about myself. Other people had told me. I did not have any sense of self-worth. And I felt such guilt, such enormous guilt. And when they said to do an inventory, how could I do an inventory? How could I find anything good about me? And I'll never forget, we sat in a closed meeting, a discussion meeting once, down at the... Oh, I must tell you, by the way, that so you don't have any misunderstandings about me. After being at the clubhouse at 324 and a half West 24th Street for about 6 or 7 weeks, something happened at home that I found that I could not handle. I went into a blind rage. I came home and found my husband beating up my son. And I went into a blind rage, and the only way I knew to handle rage was to take a drink. And so I took a large tumbler of whiskey and said, I'll show him. And, of course, I showed me. In any event, that meant that I drank for 2 weeks. Then I got sober just before Christmas, and then I drank Christmas, and I drank again. And then finally, my sobriety date is not until January 6, 1945. So I'll have 41 years of sobriety next January. The good Lord will. One day at a time. And don't forget, darlings, I'm 77. A lot of you are going to have a hell of a lot more than 41 years of sobriety when you're 47. When you're 77, I mean. So it isn't so wonderful. And I don't know where the time has gone. I don't know what's happened in my life. It's all been so exciting and so terrific. It's like two halves of my life. I don't ever want to forget that early pain. but also the joy and the excitement and the anticipation and the enthusiasm of being in AA has been the thing that's been so fantastic. You know, I used a word there that's very important to me, the word enthusiasm. Not too long ago, I've worked in the field some, too, in recent years. I was asked to speak at a seminar on alcoholism and the elderly woman. Don't quite know why they asked me, but I don't like that word, elderly. And so I went to the dictionary, as I do often. I love the dictionary. It's wonderful. There's so many words we've lost, like felicity. That's something that word means happiness. We never use it anymore. Yeah, oh, anyway, I went to the dictionary, and I found a definition for elderly that I like. And the definition of elderly is a loss of enthusiasm for life. And how are we ever going to lose enthusiasm for life if we're living the AA program? And so, darlings, we're never going to be elderly. Any of us. Right? Right. In any event, I went on with my fourth step, but I was having difficulty forgiving myself, and they had told me that the one thing I must do is to forgive myself and learn to love myself. And I thought, how am I going to forgive myself for these terrible things I've done to my children? Not sins of commission so much. I mean, I never beat them or anything like that. But the sins of omission, the neglect, the not caring or not seeming to care. The absence, the passing out and letting them run around the house by themselves. Why they never got hurt. I know it must have been God's care. And so I felt that there was nothing good about me. And I sat in that meeting in the 41st Street Club, which is where we moved after I got sober and again and went, that's the 24th Street Club, and we were now on 41st Street. And we were sitting at this meeting, and I was complaining about the fact that there was nothing good about me. And Marty Mann, who was an early member of AA, a lady who was very active in the fellowship at that point, and she leaned over and said, you know, I think if you do it the other way around, you'll find it helpful. And I said, how do you mean? She said, you're concentrating on all the things about yourself that you don't like. She said, start looking at the things that you do. Oh, I thought, oh. I didn't think there was much, but I began to work on that. And I encourage new people to do that, because I think we come in so heavily laden with guilt and self-hatred that it's very hard for us to see that there's something wonderful inside of us. Each one of us is God's perfect child. We just have forgotten about it. And so we begin to look at those things that are in us and to work on those things. And so I began to do that, and I began to think, well, I love my kids. I guess mother love is a good quality. And so I began to try and concentrate on doing the best I could with that. And by so doing, recognize those things that interfered with that process. Recognize when I was angry. Recognize when I was sorry for myself. Recognize when I was being hostile. Recognize when I was full of resentment. Because those things were going to interfere with my fulfilling the goal that I had of being the best damn mother I could be now that I was sober. And it was extraordinary how I could see these weeds growing in my garden, and I could begin to eliminate them. And so I began to try and work on self-pity and anger. And self-pity was one of my biggest problems. I can remember I was at a banquet once with Dr. Silkworth, old Silky we used to call him, the little doctor who loved drunks. And I leaned over to him. I was sitting next to him, and I said, Silky, I have an awful problem. I said, how do I manage to overcome self-pity? He said, I have a very good recipe. And I said, what's that? He said, think of anybody in the whole wide world that you want to change places with. Oh, I immediately thought of rich Rockefellers and things like that, you know. He said, wait a minute. He said, but I was saying change places. He said, I mean totally. Totally. Everything. That meant I would have had to give up my children and take somebody else's brats. You know, I wasn't prepared for that. And so suddenly it helped me to begin to recognize the value of those things that I did have. And that helped me some with that. And I know that a little later on, I went really ahead of myself. I began to work on this, and I worked at the intergroup office as a volunteer, and I began to make a little progress and a little growth. I still haven't spoken yet. I'm terrified to speak in front of a group of people, I think. I hadn't yet gotten honest enough with me to recognize the fact that I was terrified because I was afraid I wasn't going to be any good. I didn't realize that. I thought that I was afraid of you, you know. Eventually, I did begin to speak. And, of course, I haven't been able to shut me up since. And thank God for it. It was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. I remember I went in fear and trembling to that meeting. I got tricked into saying I'd speak. I was 3 years sober, and I wrote down my speech. I wrote down my speech, and I memorized it, and I had my two little darling girls sit there and cue me like I was an actress back on the stage. Thank you very much. And they would say, "No, Mommy, you don't say, you say this." Oh, okay. So then I went from there to trying to find, "No, Mommy, it doesn't say that, it says no." Okay, so I memorized this damn speech, and I went over to Lenox Hill, which is the biggest group in New York, on that Thursday night to make my debut as an AA speaker. And I was absolutely sick with fear, absolutely sick with fear. And I got up on that dais, and I recited my little lines, and I was the actress playing the part of the alcoholic and doing my little story. And you know, it was fantastic. They clapped. And you know, for the first time, I really thought maybe I was going to rejoin the human race. It was the most wonderful feeling of acceptance, the most wonderful feeling of love that I had ever experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you that today, although I get sick with fear before I'm starting to speak, I wouldn't do without this wonderful experience of going around and talking for anything on God's earth, because I get so much love back from you, it sustains me for a long period of time. Until I get to my next meeting, which will be next week in Fort Lauderdale. Anyway, I did begin to make some progress, and I did begin to grow, and eventually I knew I had to do something about Roger, because he was drinking, as I said, he got drunk every night, the children were being affected by it. And I finally made the decision that it was necessary that we be separated. And so we were separated, and I didn't quite know how I was going to get along, because I knew getting any child support out of him was going to be absolutely impossible. And at that point, the intergroup office asked me if I would come down and be their secretary. And so I went to work at an AA office in New York, the local AA intergroup office. They paid me $200 a month. They had paid the previous secretary $50 a week, which if you compute quickly is about $225 a month. But they said, "You don't mind paying a little less because we're kind of broke right now." And I was so glad to have $200 a month that I didn't know what to do. It made it possible to begin to think about making ends meet on my own. And after that, I eventually had the opportunity to go up to general service. But during those years that I was at Intergroup, it was wonderful because I began to see the progress people made as they come into AA, as they change and as they grow. And we had regular volunteers that would come in and give of their time. Of course, I didn't do 12-step work because I was okay to salary. I coordinated the hospital program and so on and so forth. But it was a wonderful experience, and I learned something about the traditions and how groups have to work together in unity, because we can't attract people to a fellowship in which there is a lack of harmony, in which there is fighting and arguments and disharmony. And so I learned the importance of that. But every now and then I'd get back into this old self-pity thing, you know. And every now and then people would say, "Hey, Eve, we're going to go out to dinner together, and then we're going to go to a meeting and or a movie or a meeting or whatever it was." And they say, "Why don't you come along?" And I say, "I can't. Poor me. I got to go home to the kids, you know." And I'd stalk out of the office, and I'd head to the bus. And I would stand there, and I'd think, they're all going out to have a good time together, and I have to go home to the kids, you know. And I'd get on the bus, and I'd head up to Riverside Drive, and we had an apartment with a great huge bay window in it. And as I'd get out of the bus there on the corner, I'd look up, and there would be Ruthie and Liz sitting in that bay window. And I'd see them say, "Here's Mommy! Here's Mommy!" You know. And I realized how blessed I was. And I learned to be grateful for the fact that my husband was an alcoholic. Because if he had not been an alcoholic, I would have lost those children, who have meant absolutely everything to me. And I found out that some of those girls who were going out to have such a good time for dinner and a meeting were living in furnished rooms, and their children were with their husbands. And I learned to be grateful, so enormously grateful, that I had, through God's grace, been granted the gift of keeping my children with me. And you know, love is a wonderful and unbounded thing, and you would never know when it's going to return. I've never been had a sick day in my life, and I don't think I've ever been really grateful for it. I just have always been wonderfully healthy and just taken it for granted. As I said, really not been grateful enough for it. Last September, when I was speaking down in Louisiana, I fell and fractured my hip. And I got home on a stretcher on the airlines, changing planes and being carried and all the rest of it. And I was immobilized for over 2 months. There was nothing wrong with me physically. I just was sitting in a damn chair for two months. And I went into the most terrible depression. And I could not get a handle on it. Because
I was immobile, and I'd never been that in my life. And my daughter came to stay with me and to help me get around because I couldn't walk, you know, all that. And her program was such a tremendous help to me. This is the same little girl that when she was about 10 years old came running in my home one day and said, "Oh, Mommy, I know what I want to be when I grow up."
And I said, "What do you want to be, darling?" She said, "I want to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA." And of course I knew what she meant. She didn't want the pain, but she wanted the love because she was so used to the love in our home with my friends who would come and spend time in our household. And so she got what she wanted. And today she's got 8 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when she came to see me and stay with me during this period last September, she had 7 years then. And her program helped me. And I began to recognize how, oh, God forgive me for some of the things I've said to people, you know, when they've been in a depression. I've said in the past, "Pray I never do it again. There must be something you're missing somewhere in the program. You're just not doing some step right. Have you got the spiritual side of the program yet? You're just missing something." I want to tell you, it is ghastly when you have a depression because you know what the answers are, but you can't make them work for you. Why, I don't know. But my daughter, who had been a depressive and had been sober then 7 years in AA, her program helped me. What a wonderful thing to have your daughter helping you maintain your sobriety, but grow in it and begin to understand more about the things that we have to do on a day-to-day basis. And so I survived that, and by January I'm beginning to feel pretty perky, and I'm rushing around again doing all the things I do like rushing around. And in March they discovered I had cancer in my neck. And so I had the biopsy, and then I had radiation for 10 weeks on my throat and my neck. That's why I have to keep drinking water. The darling doctors killed the cancer, but I don't have any saliva left. So I have to drink water all the time. Anyhow, I got very ill with the radiation. I couldn't eat and so forth and got in pretty bad shape. And my daughters both live in South Florida, one of them 70 miles away and one of them about 20 miles away. And it was like the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. Saturday, Liz would leave and Ruth would arrive. Following Saturday, Ruth would leave and Liz would arrive. The following Saturday, the reverse. And they took care of me until I was able to take care of myself. And after they left me by myself and I was able to handle and get up and move around a bit and so forth, I suddenly found these great sheets of yellow pad paper. And they'd written notes to each other, like, "She isn't eating very well. I tried a little bouillon and pasta. You might want to try that. She seems to be getting a little depressed. I think we need to get her out of herself." And then my Al-Anon daughter, who occasionally has slips, you know, one moment of compassion. She said in her note, "I think we have to get her away from the television. I could have killed her." Let me clear one thing up. I think Al-Anon is terrific. My Liz is an Al-Anon, and she has been for a long time. She had to get to Al-Anon to deal with her sister's alcoholism. And while she was in Al-Anon, guess what happened? Not too usual. She met a guy Who is an Al-Anon? Unattached. They got married 2 years ago, and he's the delegate to Al-Anon World Service from Florida, and she runs an Alateen group, and they are as happy as clams. And Ruthie, of course, with her 8 years of sobriety, is naturally married to an AA. I mean, what else? So we have it all right here in the family. It's terrific. But I couldn't help looking at those yellow sheets and looking back to the time when I would say to myself, I can't have a good time because I've got those kids. And see the love that was coming back to me. You know, everything that I have in this life is as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have been so privileged because I have had so many tremendous experiences. I left Intergroup and went up to work at the General Service Office. And that meant that I had contacts with Bill. Up until then, I'd seen Bill at meetings, but, you know, I was in such awe of him. And again, all my fear of not being worthy of even talking to the great man, you know. And I finally learned through working at General Service that he was a beautiful and humble human being. And he understood, you know, he had a terribly difficult situation. He'd sometimes say to me, he'd say, no, Evie, I can't win. And I'd say, what do you mean? And he'd say, well, somebody would come in, you know, and give me the big accolade. And I'll say, no, not really. I'm really, you know, only just. And then they say, oh, my God, he's so humble. You know, he said, I can't win. And he was in a no-win situation because people did idolize him. And I think we're all of us tremendously grateful for the gift that God gave him to see what this fellowship needed. Because, you know, Bill would have the answer to a problem before most of us even know there was a problem. And that, I think, was a divine gift. And the way he set up our structure to protect us from against ourselves. Because that's what the structure is all about, is to not protect us from something outside. Nothing's going to attack us from outside. The only thing we have to fear is that we in our imperfection, we in our humanness, we in our sick egos sometimes, will do something that will hurt this fellowship. And that's the reason that the structure is so strong, and why we have the traditions to guide us against those power brokers, as Bill used to say. And Bill often say, you know, I was a power broker myself. Because he overplayed that a little bit. He wasn't half as much of a power broker as he used to say he was, but he was doing that to try and show us, all of us, the potentials and the dangers that there might be along the road of Alcoholics Anonymous if we didn't recognize the fact that we could not let our egos run rampant. That our traditions are so important, our common welfare comes first, individual welfare comes after, and unity is so all important, and the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You know, every now and then some of my old-timer friends down in Fort Lauderdale say, I simply can't relate to these druggies that are coming in. This is a program for alcoholics. I say, what do you mean you can't relate to them? I just don't identify. I said, I don't understand you. They feel exactly the way I felt. And they are feeling their recovery the same way I feel my recovery. I said, I don't understand what there is to understand. And I said, besides which, who's talking as if this was something new? I can remember back 30 years ago going to a meeting and seeing this guy that I've been trying to help, 12-stepping or whatever, and he used to come to our group pretty regularly. And I was seeing him one night just standing there. Absolutely stoned. And I went up to him. Didn't smell anything. I said, what's the matter with Bob? Oh, he's off on barbiturates again. I mean, this is nothing new. We've always had the potential. The only thing is that it's gotten so tremendous today that it's pretty hard to find anybody who can say, I am a pure alcoholic. So the General Service Office was a fascinating and magnificent place to work. It's the heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do believe that without that office, AA would not have grown the way it has around the world. Because we could answer questions, people who wanted to know how to start groups. And I remember I used to get absolutely fascinated. We get a letter from some little group down, I don't know, anywhere, New Zealand, Australia, South America, and they would say, you know, I'm alone, and how do I stay sober? And we'd write them a letter. We had to have Spanish secretaries quite early on in order to get them into Spanish. And we'd send them literature and tell them to, you know, contact their allies, do what Carl did, to go sit in the meeting place and wait for people to come. And in about 4 weeks, we get another letter saying, we have 12 members now. I say, how can this be? And I began to get this terrible hunger that I had to go in. I've always wanted to see the world anyway, but I wanted to see how AA was functioning in the world. And you know, we rotate our service assignments there in general service. You do public relations 1 year, you do conference 1 year, you do, well now they've got a lot of new ones too, like relationship to outside agencies and then overseas, international. And I was on that international desk quite often, and it was one of my favorite assignments because I could see this growth going on. And it was so fascinating. And so I began to think to myself, oh God, it would be so wonderful if I could go over there and see that. And so one day I was talking around the office and I said, wouldn't it be nice if some of us could take a leave of absence and go and see what's going on? Well, it kind of fell on deaf ears for a little while, but about 6 months later, our manager at that time came in and said, we think it's a good idea. And so he said, Ann, you go for the first year, and Eve, you go for the second. Ann had been there longer than I. And so in 1965, I got on board a freighter right after the Toronto Convention and headed for South Africa, and I spent a whole year traveling by freighter, by train, by plane, by camel, by elephant, and I went around the world, and I visited AA all over the place. And it was fantastic to see how AA was growing everywhere and to see some of the differences. Down in Australia, they're terribly, or were at that time, this is 1965, and I think they've grown out of it a little bit. They were terribly anonymous. You never knew anybody's name. It was Racetrack Harry and Bowtie Al. And, you know, I was trying to get handles, you know, and I was doing meetings, and we'd sometimes rig meetings, you know. We'd sometimes, particularly if an area was having a problem and the people in service were trying to help solve it, they'd plant questions in the audience and I would try and field them from the experience of general service. Anyhow, we'd had a wonderful meeting in Adelaide, I remember, and I'm telling you this because it's an example of anonymity gone astray, in my opinion. We went to the airport, several of us, they came down to see me off on the airplane, and as I go to the Ansett Airlines ticket counter, I see an envelope said Mrs. Marsh on it. And so I leaned over to take a hold of it. And the airline ticket agent said, just a minute. I said, excuse me. He said, are you Mrs. Marsh? And I said, yes. Well, he said, we weren't quite certain. We thought it must be you. You appeared to be the only M on the manifest. This is for you. And he handed me a telegram addressed to E.M., Ansett Airlines, saying, thanks for coming. We've enjoyed you. Good luck. Signed, Ted F. So I turned around to the people behind me and I said, do I know Ted F.? And they said, oh, yes, my dear. He was in the chair last night. So I turned to the man and I said, yes, I know Ted F. And he said, and you're E.M.? I said, yes, I'm E.M. And he gave me the telegram. Now, I subscribe to you. That was breaking my anonymity a hell of a lot more than they just sent the telegram to Eve Marsh. I wasn't traveling around the world as a recovered alcoholic. I was traveling around the world as Eve Marsh, recovered human being. Really? And so I had wonderful experiences at all of those places. And one in particular that I loved, it was the one in Japan. Fill her up, kid. I got to Japan, Tokyo, rather late at night, and I had an assignment from the office. I needed to talk with them in the group to find out whether they should translate some of our literature. We weren't quite certain whether they were abiding by the traditions and so forth. And so I got a taxi cab and headed for the church, St. Albans Episcopal Church, which is where they supposedly had their meetings. And I got out of the cab. It was November 1965, and it was pitch black out. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was dark. And he dropped me off in front of this church right near the Tokyo Tower. And, Jenny, you'll know where I'm talking about. And, so I got out and here's this big old church in front of me. It looks empty. The fence is falling down. The steps are collapsing. And I start climbing up to try and get into this church and looking for the AA meeting. And two little Japanese girls come down out of the cloister in the back and they smile at me. And so I yelled at them. You know, if you yell, you think they can understand you. And, I asked them where St. Albans was. Well, one of them heard that St. Albans, and they pointed to another building, which is a very modern little old building. It didn't look like a church at all. So I went over there, and I spoke to the girl downstairs, and I said, is there an AA meeting here? And she said, upstairs. And so I went upstairs, and there were four doors and a head. And so I put my ear to this door, and the door said, fourth grade, third grade. And so I listened, and I didn't hear anything. I went to the next door, said second grade, and I listened and I didn't hear anything. And I went to the next door and I listened. It said first grade. I didn't hear anything. I next to the next door said kindergarten. And I put my ear to the door and I heard, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." And I was in the AA meeting in the kindergarten. Now, isn't that where we belong? Because we never graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous. We learn something new and fresh every single day. If we don't, we're missing something, I think. If we don't have that enthusiasm, if we don't have that sense of adventure, if we don't have that sense of, I just got back from China. I want to go places. I want to do things. I want to see as much of this world as I can. And I want to always know that I am carrying the AA program in my heart. If there's not a meeting, I went that year around the world, and I was worried when I first started because I thought, my God, I'm only 20 years sober. I suppose something happens to me, you know. And I discovered that the important thing was that AA was a part of me. And that's what the key is. I don't advocate going without going to meetings, but I have no fear that I'm going to get drunk if I don't go to a meeting all the time. I go to meetings because I like to be part of the fellowship. I go to the meetings because I enjoy this way of life. I go to the meetings because I don't want not to belong. I go to these meetings because I think maybe I'd be the power of example for somebody else. And I go to these meetings because I love them. Not because I'm afraid I'm going to take a drink. I tell you, I guess when I'm all these gray hairs, I'm allowed maybe one or two biases. I hope so. I don't like it when I hear someone say, after 20 or 30 years of sobriety, "Of course I could be drunk tomorrow." I don't think we can be drunk tomorrow if we're living the AA program today. And that's why I think it's so important that AA becomes a part of us. The feeling, the enthusiasm. I saw somewhere not too long ago that there are three key things in this life and that we need to have them in order to live successfully. And I subscribe to that. I think we have to have enthusiasm. I think we have to have curiosity. And I think we have to have spontaneity. You know, we used to be so rigid. We used to plan everything. Everything was controlled. And if things didn't work just the way we wanted them to, we didn't know how to handle it. Isn't it wonderful when something suddenly comes up unexpectedly? Oh, good, let's do that, you know. Spontaneity. We can do it because we're not afraid anymore. And we're not afraid because we turned our will and our lives over to the care of a power greater than we are. And I want to tell you, during that period when I was so ill this last spring, that second step meant absolutely everything to me. Because I kept saying to myself, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And sanity means health in the old Greek. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And my power has. And I am so grateful because I have things to do and people to see and places to go. And I want to do them all. And I want to do them with the love in my heart that I have gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's the key, I do believe. It's why we work. It's the spirit that we feel in every meeting we go to. And that spirit is the sense of love. And I don't know what God is. All I know is that there is something magnificent in this world. There is some creative force. There is some spirit that touches us. I think love has a lot to do with it. I found this wonderful little poem, and I don't know who wrote it, but to me, it really and truly expresses, I think, the way we feel. And to me, it's kind of a guideline for keeping this power greater than myself always in my mind and in my heart and fresh each day. He who plows and sows a field of grain or plants a tender seedling in the soil, relying on the sunshine and the rain, is trusting God. He whose heart is filled with love for all, who has compassion for his fellow men, and empathy with all things, great and small, is living God. He who gazes at the starry sky, or studies atoms through a microscope, or looks into a fellow being's eye, is seeing God. And I see God in every one of you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.